What is it with all these angry white men?
What they all express is what I call aggrieved entitlement. I should be in power. I should be getting what I want. Elliot Rodger, I should be getting girls to date me. I should be feeling confident and strong and powerful, and I'm not, and people beat me up and they make me miserable. I'll show them. I'll get even with them. I'm entitled to this.
That's Michael Kimmel. We talk with him about his book, Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era. Then we look at the rise of rape culture in America.
Rape culture is rampant. I think it's something that most of us don't realize that we participate in and propagate. You know, the words rape culture, when you hear those, you think, oh, that's ridiculous. That's counterintuitive. No one is pro-rape. No one is supporting rape. But the reality is, in so many different ways and all of these interconnected systems, we do essentially, if not condone, then turn a blind eye to rape.
That's Kate Harding. Her book is Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. It's no secret that a lot of white men are angry. The popularity of right-wing radio hosts like Rush Limbaugh and the rise of anti-feminist men's rights groups are symptoms of a toxic rage brewing among many of the country's white males. It's a rage being tapped by Donald Trump's presidential campaign. What's at the root of all this rage? My guest, sociologist Michael Kimmel, says white men, especially lower middle class white men, feel betrayed. The good jobs they expected as their birthright have gone away. Gender roles are changing, challenging the traditional rights of men in the family and the courts. Kimmel says many men fall prey to a sense of aggrieved entitlement, thinking that their country, their jobs, are being taken away from them, as if the country and those jobs belonged exclusively to them. They don't see the benefits that equality can bring and are stuck in the past, mourning their losses. Kimmel has been writing about masculinity for many years. His books include Men's Lives, co-authored with Michael Messner, Manhood in America, and Guyland. Angry White Men is out from Nation Books. Well, Michael Kimmel, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
This book, with the explosive title, Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era, we are talking now just a couple of days after a terrible school shooting in Oregon that happened, and we are also talking at a time when the angry white man in chief, Donald Trump, seems to be doing incredibly well in the polls for the Republican nomination. Could you put these two events into the context of what you're talking about in your book, Angry White Men?
I think they're both expressions of a dynamic. Surely I wouldn't make any kind of, you know, identification between Donald Trump and some guy who goes into a school classroom that he was a student in and opens fire and kills 9 people and then himself. Certainly not. But I think they are both expressions of a similar kind of emotion. And that's what I call aggrieved entitlement. What happened in Oregon is that a young man walked into a classroom and opened fire, killed 9 of his classmates and the teacher. And let's take that as a school shooting. The mass school shootings all seem to follow the same kind of pattern. It's almost always, and I mean close to 100%, a white guy in a suburb or rural area. It's almost never a young man of color in the inner city. That's not what mass shootings are about. And it's almost always some guy who feels like he was badly done by. He didn't get a good grade in a course. He didn't get the dates he wanted. That's Elliot Rodger. He was unpopular. Guys called him, you know, a wuss. Other guys may have questioned his sexuality. He was beat up and bullied. You know, that's Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris and Columbine. So every one of these boys has three things going wrong. One is they feel completely emasculated. They feel completely humiliated. They're constantly being beaten up, gay-baited, you know, bullied. Secondly, they feel that they are entitled to be powerful and strong and whatever. And third, they have access to assault weapons. In addition, the standard feature of this is that they're mentally ill. But what they all express is what I call aggrieved entitlement. I should be in power. I should be getting what I want. Elliot Rodger, I should be getting girls to date me. I should be feeling confident and strong and powerful, and I'm not, and people beat me up and they make me miserable. I'll show them. I'll get even with them. I'm entitled to this. That's one thing. Then you look at Donald Trump. Donald Trump is expressing a sentiment. This is not simply men who are expressing it, but the whole Tea Party is based on this same principle, and that is this notion of aggrieved entitlement. When I say entitlement, they say, this is our country. We have to take our country back. They have taken our country away from us. They, these unseen forces in Washington, these immigrants, these minorities, whatever, we have to take our country back. Now, the only right answer to these guys, by the way, to that question about taking our country back is, what made you think it was your country? It's everybody's country. It's my country as much as yours. So that's what aggrieved entitlement sounds like. I am entitled to this. You're taking it away from me. I'm going to get even with you. That's part of the masculinity piece. We don't just, you know, express ourselves. We blow people up. So let me go back and talk for a minute about these school shootings. Just for a minute, Francesca, just ask yourself, you think if every one of these school shootings was a poor black girl in Philadelphia, or in the Bronx, or in Newark, or in Compton, or in Chicago, do you think that we would be talking about gender and race and class? Of course we would. It would be the only thing we're talking about. We would talk about how the culture of poverty breeds violence. Someone would probably say, oh, those people in the inner city, they're just like this. Somebody would probably get the bright idea to blame feminist women for encouraging boys to be as violent, girls to be as violent as boys. But in every case, we would be talking about gender, race, and class. So when all the school shooters, all of them, are middle-class white boys, what do we talk about? Mental illness. Nobody talks about race. Nobody talks about gender. Nobody talks about class. What I think these boys all express is that kind of aggrieved entitlement. We are entitled to be in power. We're not in power. People have taken it from us. I have to take it back. And I have the means, that is to say, the easy access to guns, to do it. So it is surely not the case that, as the NRA likes to say, guns don't kill people. People kill people. Yes, that's true. People with guns kill people. People who are mentally ill with guns kill people. People who feel the sense of aggrieved entitlement. White guys, men, boys kill people with guns, and they're mentally ill. And we have to talk then, if they're also mentally ill, how come nobody noticed? Mm-hmm. How come all of these guys in their schools fly under the radar and nobody notices that they're mentally ill? It's because there's no counselors. It's because we've so starved schools for funding that there's nobody who notices. So you can't just say this is mental illness when it's middle-class white boys, and that it's something about race and class and gender when it's about poor black girls.
And you do say that it does have something to do with class, not to say that there's ever any kind of justification for violence ever, but your book is subtitled American Masculinity at the End of an Era, and there are some class issues here.
Yes, of course. So there's two things. First, these guys, all of the school shooters are middle-class guys, but I think the class issues are there are certain groups in our society that have been hardest hit by globalization, economic restructuring, outsourcing, et cetera, and that is the lower middle class. One of the other groups of angry white men that I talk about in the book are men on the extreme right wing, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and these guys are the sons of downwardly mobile, lower middle class men. Their fathers owned a small farm, which foreclosed. Their father owned a ma and pa shop, which closed when Walmart moved in. There were skilled workers in very high wage union protected jobs in the steel industry, the auto industry, the aviation industry. This is what Timothy McVeigh's family background was. All of them have the same class background. It was their fathers who lost the store, who closed the shop, who lost the farm. And these young men face a most uncertain economic future. The farm that had been in the family for generations suddenly was lost. And these guys feel entitled to a certain class position, the ability to make a good living, to support a family, and they don't have it. They can't get it.
Michael Kimmel, you also talk in the chapter on school shootings about bullying. And again, we are by no means pardoning or giving excuses for this kind of horrendous behavior. But you do put it in the context of the larger attitude, the social attitude towards masculinity. So I wonder if you could connect the dots for us there.
So all of these guys, turns out that virtually all of the school shooters were bullied, beat up. And I'm not just talking about, oh, getting shoved and called a wimp sometimes. I'm talking about daily tortured, you know, beat up, having, you know, Coke bottles thrown at you as you're walking from moving cars, as you're walking home, being pushed into lockers, being, you know, constantly beaten up. I mean, every day was a torment, a torture. And so these guys did what, you know, what guys are supposed to do. You know, you don't get mad, you get even. Now, why were they bullied? Why were they targeted? Were they all like wimpy guys who were gay? Certainly not. In fact, some of them, one of them was bullied because he was fat. One of them was bullied because he wore glasses. One of them was bullied because he was smart. He actually started a philosophy club in his school. Now, Elliot Rodger, you know, wasn't really targeted. He was just rejected by women as he tried to be a pickup artist and get dates. But they all felt like, you're not giving me what I'm entitled to, and if you're not going to give it to me, I'm going to take it. I'm going to make you pay for making me miserable.
So, in other words, to some degree, they're victims of the masculinity, the view of masculinity in our culture, at the same time as they are an extreme expression of it? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it is kind of what I'm saying. I think these guys are not, you know, when we talk about them being mentally ill, we're making the argument that they're deviant. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that they're deviant in some respects. I think they're actually overconformist to ideas about masculinity that says, when you feel aggrieved, you are entitled to use violence. You can use violence to restore what you feel is rightfully yours. So these guys are not nonconformists in a way. They're overconformists to very destructive ideas about what it means to be a man.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Michael Kimmel about his book, Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era. At the end of an era. At the end of an era as well. You have a very interesting chapter on the men's rights movement. I wonder if you could talk about that. I mean, you do divide it into two. One is men's rights and the other is father's rights. But let's just take the men's rights movement first. Tell us about Roy Denhollander. I'd never heard of this guy before.
He's a lawyer in New York City who likes to do frivolous and symbolic lawsuits. So he sued a bar because they offered ladies' night, where women's drinks were half price, and so he sued them for sex discrimination because they weren't offering men's drinks at the same price. He sued Columbia University because in this country we believe in the separation of church and state, and Columbia University had a women's studies program which is preaching a religion called feminism, which therefore means that they're promoting religion. So these are the kinds of things he wants to get attention for, pointing out those places where he believes there is dramatic discrimination against men. And that is the core of the men's rights position. The core of the men's rights position is that today things have gone so far that it's no longer discrimination against women. That's all been solved. And in fact, now the feminists have so taken over power that what you really have is reverse discrimination against men. This was the very beginning. I'll just tell you, Francesca, this was the beginning of my book, was when I was on a TV talk show opposite four of these men that I came to call angry white men. Four men who believed that they were the victims of reverse discrimination in the workplace. And so they all told a story about how they were qualified for jobs, qualified for promotions, didn't get them. They were really angry about it. And the reason that this was so emblematic to me was because the title of the show was a quote from one of these four men. And the quote was, "A black woman stole my job." And they all told stories. And then at the end, they said, I asked them one question. I said, "I have one question for you guys about the title of the show, A Black Woman Stole My Job. And I want to ask you about the word my. Where did you get the idea it was your job? Why isn't the title A Black Woman Got the Job or A Black Woman Got a Job?" Because without understanding men's sense of entitlement, that's what it sounds like. A black woman stole my job. We have to take our country back. That's what aggrieved entitlement sounds like. So that's the position of the men's rights guys, is that feminist women have been so successful that they've now flipped the switch, and men are the victims of reverse discrimination in the workplace, in the home, in policy making, in healthcare, in every arena. So they will trot out a series of all these false equivalences. What's interesting about the men's rights movement is they came out of what was once called in the 70s and 80s the men's liberation movement. And the men's liberation movement was really an effort to run a parallel to the women's liberation movement, i.e. feminism. Women are so constrained, so imprisoned by these traditional roles that say the only thing that women are good for is to be in the home with the babies and the cooking and stuff. And women said, no, we want to be neurosurgeons. We want to be athletes. We want to be, I don't know, hosts on radio shows. So that was what women's liberation was about. And men's liberation comes along and says, yes, men are also constrained by these traditional roles that force us to be robotic automatons, constantly grunting and never expressing our feelings, never able to cry, never being able to be nurturing, et cetera. That's constraining, and that's bad for men. So the men's liberation movement said we have to liberate men from these constraints. And then it morphed in the 90s, in the 80s and 90s, into what's the reason that men are so constrained? And someone came up with these ideas basically that, well, it's not actually that men are constrained by these roles. It's women who do this to us. It's feminist women who are the problem, not masculinity itself. Masculinity itself is great. It's just women won't let us be real men. And that's where the men's liberation movement became the men's rights movement. And by the way, just to let you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center now characterizes men's rights groups around the country as hate groups.
So what do you feel is the impact of groups like this? I mean, how large is their reach?
There's a short and a longer answer to the question. I wrote this book because the angry white men in America today are very noisy. They're constantly, on the internet and trolling and yelling at people and denouncing them. And, and now you see the angry white men in political circles, the Tea Party, the followers of Donald Trump, who are really captured this idea of aggrieved entitlement. And the other candidates are just basically falling all over each other trying to emulate it. In a sense, it looks very big. It looks very noisy. But in fact, I argue that the ranks of the angry white men is actually shrinking, not growing. Because most men today, most young men particularly on college campuses, most young men in the workplace, are far more gender equal and are far more interested in gender equality in their personal life than any generation ever. And the reason that I know this is, A, because women and men have never been closer friends. I'm personally from the Harry Met Sally generation, where women and men didn't believe that was possible. Well, I've got to tell you, my kid, all of his friends, they all have good cross-sex friends. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is that men say, of course my wife's going to work. She's going to be just as committed to her career as I am. I mean, it's not a big ideological thing. We need the money. And secondly, all the men that I talk to, this is entry level in workplaces, young men, millennials, Gen Y guys, they all want to be awesome dads. They all want to be around their kids. They all want to be spending time with their children. It's really important to them that they be family men. So most young men today are not going to have any patience for the men's rights groups because they don't see themselves as discriminated against. They see themselves as wanting to participate in greater gender equality. Now, having said that, there is a separate chapter on father rights groups, because here I think we're in this moment of transition or contradiction, where a lot of guys have, in fact, invested far more time, far more energy than their fathers and certainly their grandfathers were. I mean, the fatherhood today doesn't look anything like our grandfather's fatherhood looked. And, you know, many of us grew up, you know, in the era of Mad Men. Well, that doesn't look like that anymore. Fathers are no longer absentee landlords. They really want to be involved with their families. A lot of these guys feel that they've invested time and energy in the family. And then when a divorce happens, they're faced with a court system that basically treats them as if they were Don Draper. It basically has not kept pace with the behaviors of new fathers, that young fathers are spending more time and energy devoting themselves to their families. And so the courts are treating them badly. Now, along come the men's rights movement and says the reason the courts are treating you badly is because of bad feminist women. Feminism is the enemy, not the court system. But there are some really responsible father rights guys who have a good point, which is the courts are looking at these guys as if they were in the 1950s. And these guys are really living in the 21st century. And the courts will have to eventually, I think, they will eventually be looking more at the content of relationships and of families rather than simply the form and sort of automatically saying, well, the mom gets custody of the kids regardless of what the dad's been doing. Now, and just one more thing about this. Most divorcing couples get the custody arrangements that they want. So we're really only talking about 80% get exactly what they want. They both agree, and that's what they get. We're only talking about the 20% of couples where there's contested custody. So most people, the court system's working fine.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Michael Kimmel about his book, Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era. And you point out, however, that in one area, and that's in the area of domestic violence, things are really not working so fine for women, in contrast to what the fathers' rights movement may think, that women who are victims of domestic violence often get the short end of the stick in custody agreements.
Yes, that is really quite true. The data here are that it's not men who are being discriminated against entirely here. Another group that is not really getting their fair due in court and custody cases are victims of domestic violence, where that's either not considered or it's not admitted or it's not really adequately considered. And men who have abused their wives or even their children are finding that, you know, that they get access to custody. So this is a problem where the courts have not kept pace with what's actually going on in our families. And they spend much more time focused on the form, male, female, what we know about, as opposed to the content.
Now, it must be pretty painful to be an angry white man. You are a pro-feminist man. I wonder if you could talk about what it means to be a pro-feminist man and what are the advantages of that?
So I support feminism because I support gender equality. Because gender equality is not just about women. It's about gender. It's about men, too. And the data here are very persuasive that gender equality in our relationships and gender equality in our society and that gender equality in our companies is actually good for us. The happiest countries in the world are the ones that are most gender equal. And that's not only because they're in Europe, but even within Europe, the countries that are highest on gender equality also report the highest levels of happiness. On the other side, the countries that have the lowest gender equality in Europe are also the ones with the highest rates of depression. So it's good for countries. It's also good for companies. Data by Catalyst and other organizations have found that gender equality is actually good for profitability, return on investment. It's actually good for reputation. It's good for reducing labor costs. When women and men are more equal in the workplace, people are happier, they're more productive, they're far more likely to come back after parental leave, they're far more likely to be offered parental leave. So all of those things are important in corporations, so it turns out that it's a bottom-line issue. But most important to men, and this is the case that I want to make, gender equality is a good thing for men. It's a good thing for our children, it's a good thing for our wives, but it's also good for men. The more gender equal our relationships, the healthier men are, the more likely they are to go to a doctor for a routine screening, but the less likely they are to go to the ER. the less likely they are to smoke, drink, take recreational drugs, be diagnosed with depression, take prescription medication, see a psychiatrist. So gender equality is actually good for men.
And finally, you had to go among a lot of angry white men to do this really brilliant book, Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era. What was it like to be with them ultimately? How did they relate to you? And can you give us maybe an example of a time that you remember the most about doing the research on this book with these men?
Sure. Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, I had certain rules about how I would talk to them and meet them because I didn't want to put myself in any kind of danger. But I never felt like I was in any particular danger. But really what was going on, I think, was there was a certain amount of skepticism, and I wasn't going to lie to them. I said, look, I am a New York Jewish sociologist from Brooklyn, New York. Look, we're not going to agree. I'm your worst enemy, you know, as far as you're concerned. But let me tell you, here's what I think. I think people don't understand what's going on with you guys. I think people aren't listening to you. And that's their major complaint, is they believe that they're the forgotten Americans, that no one's listening to them. So I said, look, I'm not going to agree with you, but I will listen. So, you know, some of them were willing to talk to me on those terms. Now, here's the part, Francesca, that I found really interesting. These guys, you know, I thought that I would be completely disagreeing with them. But I realized very early on in the interviews that a lot of these guys were right to be angry. They had been badly done by in this system. This system has, in fact, passed them by. This system has, in fact, ignored them and trampled on them. But here's the difference. I think they're right to be angry, but it is not feminist women who cause climate change. It is not gay men and lesbians who outsource their jobs. It is not immigrants who have issued them predatory loans. In fact, immigrants are just as likely to get those predatory loans. So my feeling is they're right to be angry, but they're delivering their mail to the wrong address. We all should be angry together at the very forces that are doing all of us harm. And those, in fact, are the very forces that Donald Trump wants to prop up.
Well, Michael Kimmel, your book is Angry White Men. It's a terrific read, by the way, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you so much, Francesca. It's been a lot of fun.
Michael Kimmel teaches sociology and gender studies at Stony Brook University. Read an excerpt from Angry White Men at writersvoice.net. And tell us what you think on Facebook and Twitter at Writer's Voice. Next up, the rise of rape culture in America. Stay tuned after the break. You're listening to Writer's Voice on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Within the first few weeks of her freshman year at college, my guest Kate Harding was raped. She was far from alone. Statistics on campus rape, like rape in general, vary, but between 11% and 25% of female college students have been the victims of unwanted sexual assault. For women in general, an oft-cited figure is 1 in 6 women. But many rapes go unreported. Harding says the myths about rape, that women, quote, wanted it, or are lying about being assaulted, or were dressed provocatively so they were just asking for it, contribute to a kind of rape culture where sexual assault is minimized or explained away. The proliferation of pickup artist sites and anti-women internet trolls contribute to a culture that normalizes rape, not to speak of pop culture that glorifies the assault on women, It's so bad, in fact, that Harding wonders how many... It's so bad, in fact, that Harding wonders how so many boys grow up not becoming rapists. Her book, Asking for It, explodes the rape myths and suggests what we can do to make society a safer place for women and girls. In addition to Asking for It, Kate Harding co-wrote The Book of Jezebel with Anna Holmes and Amanda Hess and collaborated with Marion Kirby on Lessons from the Fatosphere. Well, Kate Harding, welcome to Writer's Voice. This book, Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. Tell us first, or define for us, what is rape culture?
So rape culture, the very short answer is it's a culture that really supports the needs of rapists more than victims. And what I mean by that is it's a culture where we make sure that victims are very afraid to report, that they blame themselves because we typically blame them, that they can expect to be investigated as criminals themselves if they report it to police, and that they can expect there's a very, very small chance that their case will ever actually go all the way through to a point where their rapist will see any consequences.
And how prevalent do you think this is in our society?
Rape culture, I think, is rampant. I think it's something that most of us don't realize that we participate in and propagate. You know, the words rape culture, when you hear those, you think, oh, that's ridiculous. That's counterintuitive. We don't, no one is pro-rape. No one is supporting rape, condoning it. But the reality is, in so many different ways and all of these interconnected systems, we do essentially, if not condone, then turn a blind eye to rape. And it's something that many of us who, even if we are very anti-rape in our minds, will still immediately say, like, well, what was she wearing? Well, why was she there? Why did she have so many drinks? That kind of thing when we hear about someone who was raped.
Yeah, and in fact, those are some of the 7 rape myths that mm-hmm. you talk about in this book. And I think it'd be very useful for our listeners to kind of go into them one by one. The first one is, she asked for it.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, that is the basic idea that because of how she was dressed, because of where she was, because she left a party with a guy, she went back to his room, she had too much to drink, etc., that all of those things suggest that essentially if a woman is looking for sex, then she is also looking for rape. Or if one can infer that a woman is looking for sex, as though, you know, if I go out thinking, I might like to meet someone and have sex tonight, that means any guy who decides he's going to have sex with me is welcome to. It's something that really reinforces the idea that women are not supposed to have their own sexual agency, that they're not supposed to be able to make decisions about their own body, that if they express any sexuality, then what's one more penis inside them, even if it's not one that they chose?
Right. And talking about one that they chose, you also talk about the whole idea of miscommunication, that somehow women telegraph or can't telegraph their desires, their choices, mm-hmm. in such a way that men can understand it. Could you talk about that?
Well, you know, I would flip it around, and I would say that, yes, there is this idea that men can't understand whether women are actually saying yes or no in the moment. I think that that is, and the research bears it out, that that is a myth, that, in fact, human beings are very good at understanding indirect communication. There are all sorts of ways that we say yes and no to each other without using those words, and understand each other just fine. But when it comes to this particular crime, we want so badly to believe that, you know, if it's a guy that we like or admire or that we think is a good kid or something like that, we want so badly to believe that he didn't actually deliberately choose to dominate another person's body that we tell ourselves, oh, he just didn't understand. She was giving mixed signals, or he thought she was saying yes even though she was saying no, when in reality it's really not very hard to tell whether you have an enthusiastic partner or not.
You know, we live in a culture in which hypersexuality is almost seen as the norm, that if you don't conform to that idea as a woman, that somehow you're a dog or you're not sexy mm-hmm. enough. It seems like this is so contradictory. I wonder, how do you put these two things together?
Well, I think the thing is, the hypersexualization, just like sort of undersexualization or the kind of enforced prudery of a different era, what it all does is it just tells us there is one way to be sexual, to be sexy, to have sex. And of course, there are almost, you know, infinite ways to be a sexual being in a healthy way. And when we say that sexy only looks like this, that relationships only happen like this, etc., it divorces people from their own desires a lot. And the reason we want people to remain connected with their desires is because that's what allows them to say yes as well as to say no.
Right, and we'll go back more into the whole idea of consent a little bit later, but let's continue with the myths, because they really struck me. You know, I think people just unthinkingly subscribe to them, you know, until it's just hitting you right in the face, as you do in this really wonderful book, Asking for It. So, Kate Harding, what about the idea that it wasn't really rape?
This is another thing that happens, and, you know, as a survivor myself, this is one of the things that surprised me the most when I told people I was raped, and more than one person responded, "Are you sure?" Well, yes, actually, I am sure. But that goes back to sort of the miscommunication, that there's an idea that, well, it can go one of two ways. Either it's a miscommunication and you're saying, oh, you know, the poor dear is confused about what happened to her, or it's just straight up, and this would be another myth, she's lying. That, you know, the problem is, if we don't want to believe that the man committed this act, then we have to believe that his victim is lying. And so then this becomes a whole myth of, well, oh, it was something else. It was consensual sex that she regretted. It was consensual sex, but then he didn't call her later, so she decided to accuse him of rape, which is just absurd.
Or even the idea that once sexual activity, even consensual, is initiated, you don't have a right to say no somewhere along the way.
Right, right. I mean, this is a problem. Consent needs to be ongoing and affirmative, and it can be withdrawn at any time. And people find this very frightening when you talk about it in those terms. But again, I really like to emphasize that affirmative consent is kind of the way that decent people are already having sex. It's the way that most people have sex. It's about having a concern for your partner's experience and making sure that at no point are they uncomfortable, are they wanting to stop, are they resisting you. And most of us wouldn't want to have sex with a partner who's resisting. Like, that's the thing. When we worry about these gray areas and how you might accidentally become a rapist, it's just that is so unlikely, because most of us don't want an unenthusiastic partner. The people who do are rapists who enjoy the lack of enthusiasm and the lack of consent, that's what they get off on.
You say in this book, Kate Harding, that this is a book about a common experience, and so you don't put your own experience up front and center, but toward the end of the book, you do talk more about it. Are you willing to share some of what happened to you with
Sure.
our listeners?
So it was over 20 years ago for me now, so it's relatively easy for me to talk about. Although what makes me sad is how little has changed, because I had a very typical, actually, campus rape experience, where it was early on, within the first couple of weeks of my freshman year, I went to a party, I got very, very drunk, I danced with a guy, I liked all of that, I thought, this is, you know, my new college life, it's going to be so much fun, and then I left the party with him, and I did kiss him of my own accord, and then he pushed me down and raped me, actually just on the lawn outside of the party. So, and I, you know, I was so drunk and so young and had no idea what was happening. And I went to the hospital the next day. You know, my RA was wonderful. I went and told her. She took me to the hospital. But they offered to do a rape kit, and I declined because I didn't want my parents to know that this had happened. Even though, you know, people were already telling me, it's not your fault, you shouldn't be ashamed. And I believed that. I still felt like my parents would be so disappointed and freaked out. And that was all I could think in terms of reporting it to the police. And it wasn't until later that I found out that the guy who did it to me had also previously raped other women on campus, that he had even been brought up on school charges and been forced to write a letter of apology for one of them. And so then I decided to do that as well and to file charges with the school. And they put us through a hearing and said that because I didn't get his name at the time and only recognized him later on campus, they said they believed that I was raped, but not that I had the right guy. They just didn't want to believe that this guy could have done that, even though there was evidence that he had already done it before. And, you know, the sort of kicker there is that he was a senior and his advisor was one of the people on the committee that made that decision.
So he was asked to apologize? It was like the worst that happened?
Yeah, you know, for me, it was 1992. That was my freshman year in college. And I think in about 91 or 92, this school had kind of revamped their sexual harassment policy, which is what this fell under. And prior to that, there was no firm policy in place, and they just decided, okay, you did something bad to this woman, So you should write a letter of apology because we think you're a good kid, you know.
That's not even a slap on the wrist.
I know. It's unreal. And so he got nothing for me because I think what that story illustrates is so interesting is that, you know, we victim blame and we question women's stories, but it's not necessarily because we don't want to believe that the woman was raped. It's because we don't want to believe that a particular man committed a rape. And so if you give them an option of saying, you were raped, but there is no rapist here to prosecute, as they did with me, because I admitted I didn't get his name at the time, they were like, you know, oh, that must have been a terrible trauma for you. We're very sympathetic. We're going to mark it on your transcript so people understand your bad grades, you know. But what they didn't do was throw my rapist off campus.
Well, this just illustrates another myth that you talk about, Kate Harding, in this book, Asking for It, and that is that rape is trivialized.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about how, you know, I mean, I think we can understand that rape is not a trivial thing that happens, but maybe you could put that also into a personal context. What was the impact on you?
Sure. I mean, you know, the impact on me was enormous on a lot of levels. First, because it happened so early in the term and so early in my entire college career, it colored everything else that year. It colored my social life, my ability to deal with going to classes, doing my schoolwork. It was a very small campus, so when I decided to go through with the hearing, then it was big campus gossip. Everyone knew it was me. Everyone knew the guy that I was accusing, and people had their strong feelings about that. And so, you know, I felt like that entire freshman year, I was rape girl. And as I said, my grades suffered. I left there with no plan and then transferred and ended up, it took me, you know, 5 years to graduate from college, and I went to 3 different schools. I suffered from depression, you know, and it wasn't really something I had thought of until recently. I did another interview with a younger woman who works with survivors, and she was saying, you know, what are the costs throughout a woman's life or a man's life who is a victim when, you know, this kind of thing gets you at such a vulnerable age at the very beginning of your adulthood and colors everything else? I'm very lucky that I don't believe I ever suffered from PTSD, that I'm not triggered, I can talk about this stuff, and that, you know, I've gone on to have, you know, success in my chosen career, and I'm a happy person. But it really kind of, you know, it wrecked my whole college experience and in many ways kind of delayed me coming into my own as an adult.
You have a chapter also about false accusations, you know, the myth that women lie or often lie about being raped. And first of all, we did have the experience a couple of years ago of the Rolling Stone article. You know, I think probably did a great disservice to to so many victims of campus assault. But how common is it that women lie?
So the best estimates, and this is based on a review of several studies that have been done that get a very wide range of results, but the most credible studies put the number somewhere between about 2% and 8% of, and this is of false reports to police. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're still dealing with at the very least, over 90% are genuine reports. And keep in mind that people make false reports of muggings and burglaries and beatings and things like that, too. And those numbers are similar to the false reports of rape. As far as something like the UVA story goes, you know, it's so unfortunate and frustrating. I feel like that is more than anything a failure of journalism. It was a failure of fact-checking, and it was, you know, a kind of a desire to tell a sensationalistic story without looking far enough into it, which certainly should have been an investigative journalist's job. And that's something that we see in a lot of false accusations, in fact, false reports. People say what they think people want to hear in terms of what a rape is. So the typical person who makes a false report to police is looking for attention and sympathy. They're not looking to punish anyone in particular. Often they don't even name someone. What they want is people to, you know, focus on them for a while. And so they go in and they describe a stranger rape, which is actually incredibly uncommon. They describe being beaten, brutalized, cut, stabbed, that sort of thing. whereas in most rapes, there's not necessarily any physical evidence that a rape occurred. There isn't any big sign of struggle. You know, they go in and they tell a story that sounds like the kind of rape that people actually express sympathy for, which is actually not the most common kind of rape, which is someone known to the victim who doesn't leave a mark and doesn't have fangs and foam at the mouth, basically.
And this brings up the whole issue, as we saw in the last political cycle, and I'm probably sure to see again, the whole idea of legitimate versus illegitimate rape?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that goes back to a lot of ideas about sexual purity and about women's behavior and how we're taught as women that if we restrict our movements and behavior in certain ways, then we can avoid being raped. And so then what that means is there are two kinds of women who are raped. There are the ones who do everything right and then still, you know, get dragged into the bushes by a stranger. And then there are the ones who are doing something wrong. And so, you know, they're asking for it. They made bad decisions. So somehow that means that they deserve to be raped is the way that we treat that. And it's really BS. It's all rape. And rape is about consent. It is about bodily autonomy. It's not about sexual purity or the lack thereof.
I mean, there are also many who really say that rape is not even about sex primarily. Sex may be the medium of it, but it's about
right,
power.
Exactly. That it's really more about power and domination.
Exactly. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Kate Harding about her book, Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. And you have a very, you could say, almost shocking sentence in the book. probably
I think I know
more
where you're
than
going
one.
With this. Sorry.
And that is, you write that every American boy is at risk of growing up to become a rapist. Yes. Was that the statement you thought I was going to?
Sure. It's, you know, and I say in the book right away that I'm sure that, you know, that's going to get plastered around with my face by all of the right wingers who think I'm a terrible person. Let me make it clear that I don't mean by this that men have this, you know, fundamentally rape prone nature or that boys or men are bad. What I mean is growing up in this rape culture, we don't know which boys are going to soak in these messages that tell them that they are entitled to women's bodies, that women's bodies are objects, that they deserve to control and do whatever they want with women. And those messages are so prevalent that, you know, we should really basically be applauding every boy who grows up not to become a rapist in this culture. Sorry. We should applaud every boy who manages to grow up not being racist, too. And so it's just because the culture is so saturated with this idea that women are objects for the taking, you know, that a normal, healthy relationship involves a woman saying no and a man trying to push past her resistance. You know, if you look at pop culture and so many songs, so many movies, TV shows, it's just this man relentlessly pursuing a woman who keeps saying no. And then the happy ending is when she finally says yes. And, you know, what kind of message does that send? And so if you have to grow up with all of that, like, you have to really learn some critical thinking skills to understand that, no, that's not the way things should work.
Yeah, and you also have a chapter on trolls, gamers. I think you'd include the pickup artist. The internet, it almost seems as if the internet has, I mean, I can't say that there's anything really new about the way women are talked about there or the sense of entitlement, but it does seem to have increased the field of it or somehow the acceptance of it in the masculinity culture that we have.
Definitely, the concentration of it and that, you know, those ideals of toxic masculinity that, you know, one of the wonderful things that can also be a terrible thing about the internet is that like-minded people can find each other. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's a great organizing tool for groups that might be marginalized or people that are isolated. But when people belong to a group that just coheres around an idea like hating women, that becomes very dangerous and damaging. And the amount of kind of concentrated vitriol that they can unleash on any given target is completely different from, you know, what it was pre-internet, where somebody might have, you know, let's say I published an article that a lot of guys didn't like, maybe there would be 5 or 6 letters to the editor, you know, calling me a feminist bitch, but it wouldn't be, you know, I can't look at my Twitter for 3 days because it's just a constant stream moment to moment of people calling me terrible names.
Or even afraid to leave your home, which is what's happened to some female gamers.
Yeah, there have been bomb threats when women are scheduled to speak. There have been credible death and rape threats where I know lots of women have had to get the FBI involved and get local police involved. I so far, you know, knock wood, have not had that experience myself, but it's an occupational hazard for anyone espousing feminist values today.
As we're doing this interview, the reports came in just a couple of days ago that the South by Southwest conference had announced that it canceled 2 panels, you know, that were going to deal with the issue of sexual harassment in games and this whole kind of misogyny against women online after receiving, quote, numerous threats of on-site violence.
Right.
But on the other hand, then BuzzFeed and some other sites said that if these panels were canceled, they would not participate. Do you think things are getting better, you know, after they've gotten so bad?
Well, you know, I think that's one of the great things about the internet is that you can have a swift response from the social justice community as well. Where with those 2 panels, one was about harassment and one was basically celebrating people who enjoy harassing. And the fact that they canceled them both was really galling, that it was basically like, oh, so, you know, these people are proving the point of this panel, basically, and we're going to cancel it instead of hiring extra security. I think the good thing is that because there was such a strong response from the social justice community and saying, you know, these 2 things are not equivalent, like, harassment is not free speech. Harassment is something that makes speech less free. It's something that intimidates people into shutting up. And so the idea that in order to preserve free speech and an open exchange of ideas, we need to allow harassment is actually really backwards. And I think that's the message that South by Southwest got from BuzzFeed's move and from the social justice community that was a really important message to get out there.
And you point to some other indications for hope. One of them is the growth of these affirmative consent policies. I mean, I think we touched on it lightly before, but say more, what are affirmative consent policies?
Policy-wise, it's just saying that, and usually on campuses at this point or is where the policy is happening, that when someone reports a rape to a school, instead of going to the person who's accused and saying, well, you know, did the person say no? Did the other person say no? Did they resist? Did they fight you off? You go to the person who was accused and say, what did the other person do that made you believe you had enthusiastic consent? Like, tell me specifically how that person conveyed to you that they were affirmatively consenting in an ongoing way. So it just sort of shifts the conversation that tiny bit. I mean, the person who's accused can still tell the truth or lie regardless of what the question is, but it makes people reframe the way they think of it so that it's not, did the victim resist to the utmost? Are there broken bones and bruises and cuts? Were they screaming? Were they kicking? You know, the assumption being that if all of that wasn't true, then the person must have quote-unquote wanted it. And instead saying, like, no, look, you know what? It's on both partners to know that they have a willing participant there, that the other person is enthusiastically continuing with these sexual acts. And if you don't know that, you need to stop.
You know, I think when these first started coming out and there were discussions in the media about it, it was presented as if, you know, like at every couple of seconds, you know, if you're going to go, you're going to give a kiss and then you're going to do another kiss, you have to ask permission for the other kiss. And or if you're going to, you know, take off one piece of clothing, then, you know, before you get to the other piece of clothing, you have, in other words, you have to ask for affirmative consent at every step of the way. And I remember listening to that and thinking, nobody does sex like that.
No, nobody does. But, you know, the thing is, most people who are having sex are practicing affirmative consent anyway. This goes back to what I was saying earlier, that most of us would be horrified if our partner was lying there like a dead fish, or if our partner was saying no or pleading with their eyes to stop, anything like that. And the other thing that I like to bring up, too, is that during happy, healthy, consensual sex, sometimes there are moments where you need to stop and renegotiate something because it just got weird or uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't necessarily ruin the mood. It doesn't stop the sex. It can just be like, oh, hey, you're on my foot, you know? Mm-hmm. And so this idea that if you ever open your mouth to say a word during sex, like everything will be ruined, is ridiculous. And mm-hmm. I think I don't understand if the people who propagate these myths like just don't have a lot of sexual experience, or if they are having terrible sex maybe, or if they really just want to preserve that plausible deniability, because you hate to think that people are actually out there actively trying to muddy the waters, but that's the net effect of constantly saying that, you know, oh God, this affirmative consent is a terrible policy, it's an onerous burden, you know. No, it's how good people have sex with an eye to their partner's pleasure.
And finally, the issue of celebrity rape, which has also been much in the news. Recently, Roman Polanski was, given the right by Poland not to be extradited to the United States for having raped a 13-year-old 20 years ago. And think of all the people who came to his defense.
Right.
Woody Allen, I haven't seen a Woody Allen film since the allegations came out that he sexually abused his 7-year-old stepdaughter.
Right.
What is not to understand about that?
Nothing. You know, I just saw an article today about a Missouri town where it wasn't a celebrity, but it was the same principle, that apparently it was a respected man in the town. He confessed to sexually abusing a relative, I believe, or a friend, I'm not sure, but a child. And the town is still rallying around him and saying, you know, oh, well, he must have confessed under duress. There's no way that he did this. She must be lying. And I think that we really have a problem with men that we like and admire imagining that they can do bad things. And I think that whether it's Bill Cosby or an athlete or, you know, your pastor or somebody that you just really like, you know, one of your neighbors in a small town, you have to be able to understand that someone can do good in the world and also do bad in the world. I mean, very few people are one or the other. And unfortunately, you know, rapists look like everybody else, and often they are people that you wouldn't expect.
Especially when they grow up in a rape culture.
Exactly.
Well, we've just touched on the surface of your terrific book. Really, I'd say mandatory reading, Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture, and What We Can Do About It. Thank you so much, Kate Harding, for talking with us here.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Kate Harding. Tell us what you think about rape culture at writersvoice.net or on our page at Facebook and on Twitter at Writer's Voice. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.